Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 41, section 3, which is old single column, page 458. All right, so now, our session last time, we got through the preliminary material, really for these two papers, for these this block of two papers on the universes of things. Recall, what they did. They didn't just jump right into the details of astronomy or physics. The first thing that they wanted to do, and fairly extensively, there was a lot of content there, was to remind us that no matter how much any given physical setting might seem to be just totally a phenomenon unto itself. In the big picture, nothing is untouched. Everything, to some degree, is being managed, that is engaged by beings. Even when you're down into the details of that management of things, physical things, a lot of those beings are very definitively personal. So, if you are, studying the physical domain, and you don't see any signs of personality over control, if not control, down in the details, actually, micromanaging, it's because those beings, personal and non-personal, do their manipulation of things in such a precise way that it's not recognizable as being manipulated by beings. Technically, every single automaton in the entire universe is very, very directly and definitively engaged by mind and the beings behind that mind. But the management is perfect. Okay, so it's not going to be what we expect from beings engaging things. Because when we think of that, it's like, well, okay, if I was engaging it, there would be all kinds of bloopers and whatnot in the process. Because I'm only human, we say. Well, no, there's all kinds of bloopers because you're barely human. You're mostly animal. And animals have lots of issues, relative to perfection. But if you were very, very, very definitively personal, there wouldn't be those issues. So it's really a misnomer to say we're only human. It's we're only animal origin is more to the point. And, so when... when a master, for instance, master physical controller is engaging things, that word master, that adjective is not there just to make his name sound fancy, or because, you're supposed to, bow deeply when you approach him or something, okay?
I know that would probably be.
Good reflex. It wouldn't hurt, but... especially if the conciliators are wielding the master physical controllers, you might want to get very prostate. but That's another issue. When you think about that, I mean, they are master. You know, we use that word for the master universe. Okay, so it's a perfection that's beyond finite. You know, it's a perfection that's adequate for the absentite. Okay, so it's very perfect. So if there isn't perfection of manifestation of physical things, it's either because they're not allowed yet, in conformity with the evolutionary process, to impose themselves that definitively on what you're observing, or it's probably the case that you're dealing with such a circumscribed physical system that you can ignore their influence and still basically get the correct answer. You know, and that's fundamentally what humans have to do when they're doing astronomy or physics. They have to say to themselves up front, okay, I'm interested in this physical system. Is it appropriate to ignore the influence of beings or even God or gods upon this system? If so, okay, then I can, you know, try to figure it out. But if that, the influence of beings, is not negligible, I don't know how to put that into the equation. There's no way I can get an equation. There's no way the two sides of the equation are going to balance. There's going to be this non-negligible term in there. Okay, an example of that is if you're going to try to think of the entire master universe, you can't neglect God. So, like, if you're going to try to figure out the respiration of the entire master universe in that roughly 2 billion year cycle, okay, you can't ignore God. God is basically all of the equation. So that you can't figure that out scientifically. It's beyond your ability to analyze. What's negligible is what you know about. Okay? It's almost 100% what you don't know about. What's regulating that? And that goes for the revelators. The revelators tell you, we don't have the slightest idea how that works. It's, because everything we know is negligible in that equation. Okay? But, all right, so that's the preface. They were getting us thinking about that big picture and how there's beings involved. But now we're going to zoom in on some details. And paper 41 is definitely mostly about astronomy, and paper 42 is about physics.
They don't mess with our daily weather, though. I mean, they're no good on that.
Again, if they wanted to mess with the weather, they could.
Yeah.
I mean, the master physical controllers could do anything they wanted.
Right.
Okay. If they wanted to change the sun, they can change the sun. I mean, it's just a trivial thing for them to change the sun. That's a small problem, yeah. Okay, in the scale of their nature. So if they wanted to modify the solar output, that's a trivial thing for them to do. To regulate the climate on the planet. I mean, that's just a totally trivial thing for them to do. They can do. And again, there's all these things we don't know about, when they can intervene and when they can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all mysterious. But basically, we're going forward here. We're going to think about, in general, not what they might be doing, but what's going on sort of separate from these inscrutable doings of beings. Right? So that's where we're headed here. And, they're going to jump in and start giving us a few facts about those pretty little white lights in the night sky. What are they about, Remember how recent a phenomenon it is that they were anything but just what I just said. Those pretty little lights in the night sky.
Campfires
of the gods. They were, if they were anything, they were some sort of anthropomorphism, of the celestial sphere.
So you think early on that they couldn't think of them as like our sun?
Correct. No, I mean, that's a very, very recent thing for us to recognize that the sun is a star. That's a very recent phenomenon.
That seems so obvious.
Right. See, all the things that seem so obvious to us because we were born marinating in it.
Yeah.
Okay? You've got to recognize that none of this was even remotely obvious a very short time ago. You go before the Enlightenment, and you know a lot of things that are just seemingly completely self-evident to us were not at all to even the most brilliant minds alive.
Sunblock would have been like sacrilege. I
want to
block that.
All right. So, it's a very recent thing that we've been trying to figure out scientifically what those objects are. Now, should it be surprising that the things we think we've figured out in just this very short period of time, just a few centuries, should it be surprising to you that we maybe have some issues with our so-called knowledge of the stars? Okay, in just a single section here, the Revelators are going to lay waste to most of our so-called knowledge of the stars. Okay, they're not allowed to give us, you know, the things that we can figure out, but they're going to say a few things to help us to have a better set of initial assumptions for our astronomy and our physics. Okay, things that we can't figure out, and we can notice the contrast between what they say and the things that we think that we've figured out.
Yeah.
Okay, reminding us that no, you actually haven't genuinely determined that quantity. You're way off. And you, there's no way you can get close. And that's why we're allowed to tell you a little something so that you can calibrate your methods and get zeroed in on this better. All right, so let's start out. There's a lot of content in each paragraph, so we'll read a paragraph and then we'll try to slowly step through it. Okay.
3, our starry associates. There are upward of 2,000 brilliant suns pouring forth light and energy in Satania, and your sun is an average blazing orb. Of the 30 suns nearest yours, only 3 are brighter. The universe power directors initiate the specialized currents of energy which play between the individual stars and their respective systems. These solar furnaces, together with the dark giants of space, serve the power centers and physical controllers as way stations for the effective concentrating and directionizing of the energy circuits of the material creations.
Okay, so you notice how this is a transitional paragraph. The latter half of that paragraph is hearkening to what we've read previously, you know, in the previous sections. So let's do that first, and then we'll start to get down into the astronomic facts here. Okay, pretty radical stuff. The universe power directors initiate the specialized currents of energy which play between the individual stars and their respective systems. Interesting how they say play between, okay? And they say these solar furnaces, together with the dark giants of space, serve the power centers and physical controllers as way stations. Okay. Now, if you recall what a way station is, it's a potential stop along the train track, but the trains don't automatically stop there. But you can tell them to stop there. So in other words, these stars are in general like way stations. You don't think of them as being directly plugged in to this energy grid that they're talking about here. They tell you that a star of an inhabited world, once that world gets settled in light and life and things are heading towards eternity, the sun for that inhabited world or that inhabited system, does get eternally encircuited, actually plugged in to the grid. Energy stops there, goes into it. It isn't just passing by. But before that, is what they're saying here. In order to set up this energy grid, they actually leverage off of the stars and dark islands of space. They use them as a means to, as they're saying, to concentrate and directionize this grid that they're setting up. Okay, so that's all very mysterious stuff that has to do with the sub-electronic levels of energy that we currently scientifically know nothing of directly. And, you know, just leaves you kind of in awe of an unseen physical universe that's out there, you know, and that all of these stars are being used, you know, even if they're not only going to be around for a while, they blow up in a supernova or something. While they're there, the power beings are using them, leveraging off of them, you know, and the physics of that is, you know, I can't describe. It's completely unknown.
Yeah. So of the they talk about 30 of them.
I haven't gotten there yet. That's next.
Okay.
Do the first part, you know, the second here. I just wanted to get that up front. Okay, so. So, yeah.
They're leveraging for it. To what end?
To help them to have a stable grid that does whatever it is that it's supposed to do, which is stuff that we don't understand. You know, when they say concentrate and directionize, okay, without them, they can't direction it well enough. They can't get it concentrated well enough. It'll diffuse. So, you know, I mean, the one thought that you might have, it's like, well, we've started doing this some with the planets. When we want to send a spacecraft into the outer solar system, way into the far outer solar system, you know, we'll slingshot off of Jupiter, say. You know, we'll leverage off of Jupiter. Okay, see, they're doing, you know, something much more profound. Okay, but like that, for that spacecraft, Jupiter is not the destination. It's a way station. It's the way. It's a means to an end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Something got directionized even.
Okay. Yeah, and directionized, and yeah.
Well, they say respective systems, so they have a mathematics of systems mm-hmm. that we don't have, and so the individual parts are just.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just you know, the thing there where there's not just saying stars, but their respective systems, you know, especially if there's a lot of very significant mass in that system besides the star, you know, that would be an obvious reason you'd include the whole system in that description. But, you know, if it's an inhabited system, the power beings have done all kinds of modifications to the system. I mean, our solar system is heavily modified by the power beings. If they hadn't, it wouldn't be inhabitable. Okay, all kinds of manipulation that's a background that we don't recognize, that everything is built upon, you know, quote unquote. And so, obviously, if it's an inhabited system and there's a whole modification in the local environment, you have to take that into account if you're using this as some sort of a lever, you know, some sort of a fulcrum, lever point.
How many of these systems are inhabited? Is there any way to approximate?
Well, how many of what systems?
A little solar systems, within the solar systems, how many of them? They're not all populated.
No, not. I mean, remember how? Yeah, I can even pull that out. I think I remember the number off the top of my head. Yeah, for the 619 inhabited worlds in Satania, remember how there's that spot towards the beginning of part two, where they allow you to calculate how many systems it takes to get those 619. It was 562. So 562 systems. Currently in Satania are being used for inhabited worlds. Well, it says here there's upward of 2,000. Right? Okay, so a lot of them are not inhabited. Okay, and you could try extrapolating that to the bigger picture, but we at least know that much for our local environment, you know, our local system. Okay, and that's a good segue into getting into the rest of this content. Okay, so now here's the spot that I've referred to way back when we read that I was about the 619, 562. Remember how we were trying to figure out about what fraction the Andromeda Nebula is of the entire local universe of Nebulon. And extrapolating that led you to think that maybe Andromeda is about 1/9 of Nebulon. Okay, because remember, Andromeda is only a million stars. You know, only gave rise to about a million stars, that little spiral galaxy. So it's pretty tiny, even relative to a local universe. Okay. You know, and so maybe it's like a ninth. Well, here, you know, you've got another data point. You've got 2,000 brilliant suns. Okay, well, you don't know how many are, you know, binary systems and stuff like that, but, you know, just, you know, naively extrapolate this. Well, okay, if there's 2,000 in a local system, then take that times 100, you know, to get a constellation, and another 100 to get a local universe, and you've got 20 million. Well, Andromeda only has about a million, so that'd be about a 20th. Yeah. Okay, so we've got, you know, we've got a couple numbers. You know, maybe you could say maybe it's somewhere between, you know, a 9th and a 20th. You know, but there's all kinds of, you know, assumptions going on there and stuff. But it's just, you know, back of the envelope. So that's the other number that gives you, you know, a handle on this. Now, they say of the 30 suns nearest yours, there are only three are brighter. Okay, so start with the three are brighter. Okay, and we know what those are. Okay, so very close to us, there's the Alpha Centauri system. That's the closest star system to us. The Alpha.
It's one star.
No, the Alpha Centauri system. Has three stars. Now, technically Proxima Centauri, which is why it's called Proxima Centauri, is the one of the three that's closest to us. There's a close binary pair, Alpha Centauri A and Alpha Centauri B, and then Proxima Centauri, you know, which is more remote. You know, it's not in there. Close, like those two are, you know, really just going around each other, really close to each other, or, you know, really close binary pair. Okay, but one of those stars, Alpha Centauri A, is very similar to the sun, very, very similar, just a little bit brighter. Okay, so that's one of the three.
And how far away is that?
That's Alpha Centauri A is about 4.4, a little less than 4.4 light years away.
So that would, what's that, like 20 trillion miles?
A number in miles that makes it irrelevant how many miles it is. This is a gigantic number.
We think in miles here, okay. On Earth.
Yeah, right. A very huge number.
So when we see it at night, okay. You're actually looking at two stars.
Yeah. Yeah, you're looking at two stars when you see that Alpha Centauri in the night sky. You know, it takes light 4.4 years, you know,
to get there,
right? Or, you know, that light that you see in the night sky took that long to get here. Okay, so that's one. And see, and it's brighter, but just a tiny little bit. The other two are much more significantly brighter. One is Sirius A, because that is actually a binary system too, where the other one is a white dwarf. And then the third is Procyon A, because that's also a binary system, where the other one is also a white dwarf. Okay, so that brightest star in Canis Major and the brightest star in Canis Minor, you know, the greater dog and the lesser dog, those two constellations, you know, near Orion. Okay, those two. Sirius is the brightest star in the sky. So it's not only innately brighter, it's pretty close. And so that's why it's very bright. Okay, and same way with Procyon. Pretty bright star because it's innately fairly bright, not as bright as Sirius innately, but quite bright. Nothing is closer than Alpha Centauri. Okay.
So what you're saying is that were you on a planet, some of those places, our sun would look quite bright like they do. If it's
if I go to Alpha Centauri, our sun will look, you know, as bright as Alpha Centauri is, because I mean they're basically exactly the same brightness, you know. Right?
Does Alpha Centauri have any planets, Cornwell? We don't know.
You know, they're starting to find planets around some of these things, you know, but that's, you know, in the early stages. Okay, you know, so that's kind of just a technical issue,
right,
of you know, why it would be. Someone wants to get in.
Oh, that's a open up.
Well.
Okay, so. So the other curious thing there is why did they pick of the 30 sons? Okay, you know, why did they say 30? I mean, actually, you know, more than twice that many. If I take more than twice that many, you know, that are close to us, right?
60.
You know, I mean, 60 or more. I mean, it's there's still only three that are brighter. Okay. So if you think about it in detail, you go, oh, there is some content there. There, you know, I mean, like we've said, nothing is random here.
It seems like if it says we're an average blazer, there'd be about 15 bigger and 15 smaller.
No, okay. So, I mean, it's one thing to say that we're kind of, in the middle of relative to the brightest and the dimmest. It's another question of, well, you know, are there lots and lots of, are there equal numbers of brighter ones and dimmer ones?
Yeah, don't know.
No, that's what they're trying to tell you there. I mean, you know, 1/10, 3 out of 30, right, are brighter. And one is only, you know, ever so slightly brighter. Yeah. Are you looking for...
Is this the Urantia study?
Yeah.
Is that perfect?
Yep. Okay, so... they're purposely picking 30 instead of 40 or 50 or something like that, because they want to give you a sense of that ratio. You know, that most stars are dimmer than the sun. I mean, all the nearest stars, by and large, they're significantly dimmer than the sun. Okay, cooler, you know, innately cooler and dimmer. Okay, so they're giving you, you know, you don't know how much you can, you can extrapolate that, but you know, probably they're trying to give you some generalized sense of how, in general, you know, very few stars are brighter, you know, even in the whole Milky Way galaxy. Now, one other little thing that you can add to that. Remember when they tell you early on that there's about 10 trillion stars, in Orvinton, but 2 trillion are so dim or far away that, you know, well, they're not ever going to be observable from here. See, so there's that's, you know, 1/5 of them, right? See, so that gives you, you know, that fits in with this about, you know, most stars are not that innately bright. And they're trying to just give you a little kind of back of the envelope sense of that proportion by picking 30.
So on some of those, if we were on a planet that had conditions similar to ours, you'd have to be closer to the sun.
Right, if you wanted the conditions to be similar to ours.
Yeah.
But remember, the life carriers can make
all kinds of rules. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you could have, inhabited worlds all kinds of different distances from all kinds of different, luminosity suns.
Right.
Was there a question there, John? Or
well, yeah. So what basically we're saying is, if we're an average size, but we're brighter than most, then for some reason we are burning brighter.
Well, they'll get to that. You know, that's later in the section here. Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. So, that took us half an hour just through that one paragraph. Yeah. Okay.
So, is there a correlation between the dimness, brightness, and the age?
That's what John was just saying, and we'll get to that in a little bit in the section here. They'll make some comments about that. There's no trivial relationship, but I'll give you some rules of thumb here later in the section. Okay, now let's get a whole bunch more stuff.
One of my favorite paragraphs in the book.
This is Steve's paragraph.
The sons of Nebadon are not unlike those of other universes. The material composition of all suns, dark islands, planets, and satellites, even meteors, is quite identical. These suns have an average diameter of about 1 million miles, that of your own solar orb being slightly less. The largest star in the universe, the stellar cloud Antares, is 450 times the diameter of your sun and is 60 million times its volume. But there is abundant space to accommodate all of these enormous suns. They have just as much comparative elbow room in space as one dozen oranges would have if they were circulating about and throughout the interior of Urantia and were the planet a hollow globe.
All right. Okay, so now they're starting to give us some details. All right, and notice how they start. The assumption that scientists always make is valid, that we can study things that are close to us so that, for which we can get some reasonable information, because it's close, and we can extrapolate. The sons of Nebadon are not unlike those of other universes. The material composition of all suns, dark islands, planets, and satellites, even meteors, is quite identical. They even use the word identical. And it's basically because it's the same 100 elements, everywhere. Okay, the only difference are things like, depending on the environment, more or less of those 100 elements will be stable. There's issues like that, environmental variations and stuff, but it's not like one local universe has a totally different set of elements than another local universe or something bizarre like that. Including the outer space levels, it's all the same stuff. Okay, so that's really important to have them validate that. Because there's few more fundamental assumptions going on in physics and astronomy than an assumption like that. So to have the relators validate that is important. Because there's a whole bunch of other assumptions that we make that they're going to, refute. So they're helping you both ways. Which one of your assumptions are invalid and which ones are valid. Especially because there's no way we can go to every galaxy in the master universe and make certain that it actually is identical, and that is and that we're not making a false initial assumption there. So they can tell you that. And in the case of the revelators, the solitary messengers have explored and other beings have explored the outer space levels and can report back that yes, that stuff is the same as in here. Okay, so it's so that's an important point. Now, okay, so they're going to start by telling you a little bit of basics about size. It's often the case that when they're talking about the Earth relative to other inhabited worlds, they tell you we're kind of in the middle of things. Notice it's happening here with our sun, too. It's probably a correlated fact that the sun is kind of in the middle ground of the stars, just like the Earth is in the middle ground of all the various variations of inhabited worlds. And so they say that the average diameter is about 1 million miles. That's a pretty neat little data point to have for them to take trillions upon trillions of stars and give you an average like that. Pretty hard for us to get an average. We can just barely figure out our one star. You get to Alpha Centauri and it's starting to get fuzzy. Okay, but and we know ours, like they're saying, is slightly less. I'm trying to remember. Let's see. I think in miles, isn't it something like, I think it's like 865,000 miles or something like that. You know, so it's a little less than a million. You know, but it's in that near the average. Okay. Now, why do they give us all this detail about Antares? That's that bright red star, you know, in the constellation Scorpius. Yeah. What's up with that? Okay. That star is so big and close enough that we can figure out its angular diameter. We can figure out how many, you know, how big of an angle, you know, is subtended by the disk of that star. Okay, a lot of stars are just like points. But that one, you can actually get a sense of, you know, the angular size of the disk. Well, if you know the angular size, if someone were to tell you, how big it was, relative to an object we know, like the sun, like if they told you it was 450 times the diameter of your sun, you know the angle, you know the actual diameter, you know how far away it is.
You've got a calibration.
Right, you've got a calibration point. Okay. I mean, if you look up Antares, and you'll see that we have a calculated diameter. It's not even close to 450 times. Our calculation is way off.
Bigger.
We think it's a lot bigger because we think it's a lot farther away than it actually is. Okay.
Does Antares mean not Mars?
I don't know. I don't know what the etymology of that is. But it's not just that. If you have any curiosity, you might go, okay, they give me, you know, the diameter. Why give me the volume? Can I just, you know, cube numbers? And so you try it, you know. Try taking, 450 times the radius, cube 450 and see if you get a volume that's 60 million times the volume of the sun. No, you take 450 cubed, you don't get 60 million times the volume of the sun. You get a lot bigger number than that. Oh, it's not spherical. They need to give you another data point. Okay, they give you the volume. I need the volume, so you know how oblate that spheroid is, how flattened that spheroid is. It's a big star, it might be kind of flattened. If it's rotating at a reasonable rate, it might be kind of bulged out, right? Yeah. And it is. I mean, if you do the quick little calculation, you'll see it has a flattening of 1/3. Okay? In other words, the polar diameter is 2/3 of the equatorial diameter. Wow. To get you 60 million like that. Mm-hmm. Okay,
is
that's
spherical though?
It's circular in the equator, okay. But it's an oblate spheroid. You know, take a sphere and squish it, down the poles by a third. Yeah. Flatten it by a third.
Paradise is something like that too.
Right? Well, paradise is a total pancake, but okay. Right? But they've got to tell you that because, okay, if we, have some way of figuring out, how far it is across the sun, it's like, well, are we doing it along the equator or at some angle? Are we doing it, So they've got to give us that. We've got to take that into account. We've got to figure out, if we figured out a diameter, how is that related to the equator or the pole? It's going to make a difference, It's a significant flattening. It's flattened by a third, okay? So they give you that as another, so in order to actually figure out, how far away it is, you're going to have to figure out what that angular diameter is we've measured, how that is, relative to the pole and the equator, okay? That's an additional issue. This got to be sorted out. But between the two of them, see, there's the potential for you to have a calibration point.
Have you done this?
no, because I haven't figured out, you know, if you can assume it's the equatorial, and then you can figure out how far it is away, right? Okay. But I haven't figured out if we have any way of knowing yet, other than another reason why Antares is important. If you look where Antares is in the sky, you notice it's not that far from the ecliptic, the plane of the solar system, you know, which is also not that far from the equatorial plane of the sun. Okay. Think about the origin of our sun. Our sun is one of the, you know, roughly million stars in the Andromeda Nebula, this little spiral galaxy that got incorporated into the Milky Way galaxy. Okay. You know, everything has, you know, conservation of angular momentum as it's formed like that. Now, they tell you the Andromeda Nebula got disrupted a little bit by neighboring things, so it wouldn't be quite as flat as it started out as a little spiral galaxy. Okay, but let's assume it didn't get extremely disordered, at least maybe in the case of our sun. Maybe our sun is still kind of in the plane of, you know, that little spiral galaxy. Well, that means the equator of the sun would be in the plane of that galaxy, and the equator of Antares, which is probably that central residual. You notice they called it the stellar cloud, Antares. They tell you in another spot in the book that at the center of that Andromeda, you know, former Andromeda Nebula, there's a residual, very large star. This is all the stuff that didn't get flung out and is residually condensed in the core of that. It's probably Antares. Okay? And see, not only is it a reasonably close, very big star, so it's a possibility, but it's pretty close to the equatorial plane of the sun. So it's kind of suspicious that Antares is that residual core, okay? And so one of the... of the Andromeda Nebula. I mean, Antares, you know, could be a long ways away from the center of Nebadon. Because again, the Andromeda Nebula is only a ninth or a 20th of all of Nebadon, okay? We don't know where the center of Nebadon is, but we, you know, you can be very suspicious as that's the center of, you know, so Salvington isn't in the direction of Antares. Very unlikely. Okay? You know, it might coincidentally be, but there's no reason to believe that it should, you know, that it has
except
to be.
For the J in the sky.
Right, except for that rationalization scheme about the J in the sky, yes. Scorpius, its tail looks like a J in the sky. You know, if the way we figure out its angular diameter is, because it's so close to the ecliptic, the moon occults it. You know, the moon passes in front of it. Okay? And this allows you to figure out its angular diameter. Well, see, it's probably pretty likely, see, you know, that we are pretty close to measuring its equatorial rather than its polar diameter. So you could start with the assumption that, you know, that that angular diameter that we get is directly comparable to the 450, you know, equatorial diameter. You know, but they're giving you that so that you have some recognition that if, you know, if you start trying to use that and things don't match up, you know, you've got that degree of freedom that maybe, you know, you're at an angle that you can figure out and you could pin down your calibration better. Okay. So that's all. See, just one little sentence like that has all of these huge ramifications. Okay. All kinds of study needs to be done to try to pin that down more tightly. And then your entire distance system and everything has to be completely modified. Everything that, all the stuff that astronomers have ever done has to be completely reworked, okay? You know, based on this sort of stuff. There's a huge amount of human effort that every little sentence like this, you know, produces.
Yeah. What is the differential between the distance this would give us to Antares
and what this
continent? Like, I mean, instead of getting 550 light years, you'd get 330, say. Right.
How do they currently calculate how far away is it?
They try to use parallax. You look at Antares when the Earth is on one side of the sun, and then look at it again when the Earth is on the other side of the sun, and holding your finger up in front of your eyes and blinking, back and forth, and the parallax of your finger apparently moving, when you look at it with your left eye and your right eye, that's what you do. You see how much Antares appears to move in the sky as you look at it with the Earth on each side. But it's getting way down, in the noise of that mechanism of using parallax to figure out its distance, And we think that number is good. But the revelators here are telling you, no, you're way off. Okay? Doesn't matter how much you think you don't have a lot of error in that measurement, you do. And you need to rethink about that whole system until you figure out where the unknown error is. There's a whole bunch of errors that we have in all of our measurements that we have no knowledge of. Only through revelation can we know that there's errors. Okay? In almost everything that we measure. In astronomy, and everything we assume about the evolution of stars. Okay, so they're trying to give us data points to pin that down. Okay, now the analogy that they give at the end there of the oranges inside of a hollow Earth. Okay, they're trying to help you to. Have a sense of the scale of things. And they've given you enough information where you can check this to see if it's a valid analogy. They've told you that on average, stars are about 1 million miles in diameter. Okay? And they've said, think about 12 stars or star systems. So forget about whether or not it's a binary star or something like that. And so you say, okay, so if I start at the sun, there's one star system, and start moving out into all the nearest star systems. What if I take the next 11? So including the sun, I have 12 star systems. Even though like Alpha Centauri has 3, take it as just one. So it's going to be, that one star system is going to be like one orange. Okay, so if I have 12 of those star systems, how big of a volume does it take to get 12? Okay, you just look at what we've, and those numbers are valid. Those are close enough numbers that parallax gives you, a good distance. Okay, and you get about 10.5 light years radius. So you have a sphere of a radius of 10.5 light years with 12 little spheres inside of it, each of a diameter of about 1 million miles. Okay, so you have a ratio there, see, of the size of the oranges, quote unquote, to the size of the hollow sphere that they're in. Is that ratio the same as an orange to the diameter of the Earth? And if you take a big orange, if you take a 4-inch diameter orange, so on the bigger side of oranges, and they range from about 3 to 4 inches in diameter, take a bigger orange, and you get almost exactly that. Okay, so sure enough, just a quick little back of the envelope calculation, you can see that they've scaled that down. That if you. They may be trying to help you in a more general. I'm just taking the local density of stars that I know that we know something definitive about, where the distances are valid. Sure enough, it matches right up. Very, very similar ratio if you take just the closest 12 systems, and how far they are, what size volume that fills. Okay, so so that, you know, it, you know, you want to always check this and see if, you know, if it doesn't agree, you know, are they trying to tell you something? Like, you checked multiplying, you know, taking the cube of 450, and you noticed you didn't get 60 million. And you're going, okay, they're telling me something else. You know, that it's oblate in that case. So every time they tell you something like this, you know, go through the calculations and see if there's something between the lines. Okay. But anyway, so, you know, that allows you to picture just how much comparative room these stars have. You know, there's a lot of elbow room. You know, I mean, 12 oranges in this room would have a lot of elbow room. Okay. Let alone rattling around inside of a sphere the size of the Earth. Okay. You know, it's a long way between the stars. Okay. A very, very long way.
Let's not make it longer by saying that the Milky Way is just the lighter sector or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, when they tell you that it's 200,000 light years from here to the center of the Milky Way galaxy, even though that's, you know, way different than what scientists tell you, you know, I mean, that is just a gigantic distance, okay? You know, this idea of, I don't want Orvinton to just be the Milky Way galaxy and the immediate environs. I want it to be, you know, include the Virgo cluster and all this sort of stuff. Okay, it can't be that big. It can't be managed if it's that big. It's barely manageable if it's just the Milky Way galaxy. Because the run-of-the-mill beings can only go three times the speed of light. You know, several hundred thousand light years is a long haul, three times the speed of light. Okay. It becomes completely unmanageable if you make the grand universe any bigger than it is. It's just, it would be completely unmanageable. You know, it's as big, I'm sure it's maximized. It's exactly as big as it can, as you can manage it. Not one nanometer bigger. Okay? They maximize the size. Anything bigger, and it would not be possible for the beings to manage it, even with the number of solitary messages you have and whatnot. It would just become unmanageable. Yep.
Well, also, he said, if the world, I mean, if the planet was hollow, mm-hmm. if the movie Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Right. This is why Steve's favorite paragraph, because there's all these speculations about, you know, the potential of a hollow Earth, and so it's a fun paragraph for that. You know, to get you thinking about that. Now, of course, in this case, you know, notice we don't want it to have a very just hollow in the center and a crust. It's got to be zero thickness crust to make the analogy work. Like I said, I mean, if you actually calculate it, you know, you need the full diameter of the Earth in order to get the ratio correct. Okay. okay. Yep.
So why not make it smaller to make it a little more convenient? Why aren't things more condensed? That's a question yep. Chris can't answer.
Now, I would say that the reason it's maximized is simply because of what the Supreme is. The Supreme, by definition, is the maximization of the finite. You know, and part of the Supreme is the Universal Mother. You know, the size of the Universal Mother is literally the size of the grand universe. Right? Did I say Universal Mother? Okay. Yeah, you know, that the mother for the entire grand universe. You know, that's the size of her body, is a grand universe. So, you know, and that personal purposive part that's of what's going to be the Supreme Being, you know, the Universal Mother, you know, if the Supreme is going to embody the maximization, you know, you see that literally.
You'll see it in creation.
Okay. I mean, so it's only logical that it, you know, what I was saying, that's why I said what I said, that it, I think it by definition has to be a maximization, simply because yet it, you know, in many ways is the embodiment of the Supreme Being. If you made it smaller, you couldn't make the Supreme Being. You couldn't make the maximization of all finite potential. All right. Okay, so now they're going to get into some details. So those, I'm not surprised that it took us quite a while for just those first two paragraphs, because it's kind of getting the ball rolling. Now they're going to give us a little sense of the internal details that are very mysterious, okay? I mean, obviously, you know, we're only guessing about what the interior of our star is, let alone the interior of stars that are, you know, so far away that they're a point in the sky and can't even be resolved as a disk, okay? It's pretty presumptuous of current science to say, I don't know, we know to 90 decimal places what's going on inside of every star as far as the eye can see. I mean, that's just ludicrous.
We sent a probe okay. in there.
Yeah, right. You know, we think we know everything about them because more and more we put theory before observation. You know, so we have a theory, therefore we know, even though we haven't observed hardly anything. Okay, so they're going to start to give us some ideas about the interiors.
When suns are too large, are thrown off of a nebular mother wheel, they soon break up or form double stars. All suns are originally truly gaseous, though they may later transitly exist in a semi-liquid state. When your sun attained this quasi-liquid state of supergas pressure, it was not sufficiently large to split equatorially, this being one type of double star formation.
To read the next paragraph too.
When less than one-tenth the size of your sun, these fiery spheres rapidly contract, condense, and cool. When upwards of 30 times its size, rather 30 times the gross content of actual material, suns readily split into two separate bodies, either becoming the centers of new systems or else remaining in each other's gravity grasp and revolving about a common center as one type of double star.
Okay, so that range of a tenth to, you know, roughly a tenth to 30 solar masses, okay, is a validation basically of a sense of the range that we've figured out over the last 100 years. Okay, that in general, stars are in that ballpark, from about a tenth the mass of ours to about 30 times the mass of ours, and they're pointing out that unlike what scientists think now, where they think that there's a lot of stars that are, you know, 10 times more massive, okay, if not even more than 30, that, you know, we're off in imaginary land, okay, that the physics doesn't support that, that, you know, it will, you know, the rotation of the star, if it gets bigger than that, it will cause it to turn into a dumbbell and split into two stars, okay?
Antares, even though as big as it is not?
Is not. Bigger.
Mass you're talking about.
Yeah, it's not. It's even though it's 450 times the diameter,
right.
You know, it's maybe
6 million,
you know, maybe it's 20 or, you know, even less solar masses. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think their current guesses are, you know, of course, kind of all over the place because they have to do with their assumptions about the theories of stars and stuff. You know, but they've got numbers, you know, I think that are in the range of like 15 to 20 or something like that. You know. I think even I've seen like 12 or, so, yeah, but, you know, what it is actually, who knows? But anyway, they're just trying to point out that, you know, if you look in an astronomy text, you can probably find a chart where the range goes from a tenth to 30, you know, and that's because, you know, you look at lots of things and you get some rough sense of what their size is, and pretty much every star falls in that range. There's going to be some a little bit smaller, but bigger, they're pointing out, no. Okay.
Let me ask you a question.
Yep.
confuses me a little bit is when they say, you know, with this rule, they can only tell us what we know, and that a lot of the cosmology that they tell us will become outdated in a short period of time. And if you're saying that this is the way we think it is, and I don't know if it was in the 1930s or not, can you explain to me the difference between being able to determine that this is something that, that they can tell us what we knew at that point that may change over time versus that this is telling us something that we didn't know?
Right. Yes, yes. The way you can tell the difference is, remember, the whole point of the book is not to reveal facts. It's to reveal truth. So, because that's the case, that the purpose is to reveal truth, not merely fact, when you see a fact, you know, think about what truth is flowing through that. There are times when they want to reveal a truth, but they have to use some facts in order to contextualize that revelation of truth. And those facts will become outdated. For instance, if they use the Hubble constant, they're going to use the old one from the 20s, not some more modern one. But you can tell the difference between a fact that is just being presented that you can run with, and one that you can't run with as an isolated fact, about whether or not that fact has a factual context. If it's being used as a means to an end or not. If the fact in the revelation is an end in itself, then it's a fact that we either can't get, or if we do get it, we're going to get the incorrect answer. So they can just give us that fact. And they need to, because if they don't, we can't calibrate things. We, you know, we can't get a sense of the truth of the big picture. Our big picture will be distorted, and so it won't be truthful. Okay, it'll be an erroneous big picture. Like I said, it's very easy. It's very easy to do. I mean, you just, you know, if you look at the Hubble constant, it doesn't appear by itself. You know, it's given the Hubble constant, which is the slope of a line, is given along with the y coordinate. There's two numbers given together, not one number by itself. The whole point is to put those two numbers together and get what the x coordinate is, okay, which is 300 million light years. And they say when your telescopes will get better, you'll discover that most of the galaxies in the outer space levels will seem to be about 300 million light years away. Yeah, that build out range in the second outer space level. They're trying to reveal the truth about the, you know, about how the master universe is being built out by the force organizers. Okay, they use an outdated Hubble constant and a seemingly arbitrary velocity. But you put the two together, and you get something that we didn't start to notice until the 90s. And we have a false rationalization of it now. Okay? The outmoded stuff is that sort of stuff. You know,
so you have to know it. In other words, someone like me,
you have to
know any of that.
Right, you've got to be able to think about it scientifically.
Right.
And see, you know, when they tell you the Andromeda galaxy is about a million light years away, in the revelation, that's a fact just unto itself. It's not being used to get you something else.
But then they say it's going along with us, right?
No.
Okay.
No, they did. They just tell you that distance, the Andromeda Galaxy, and you're going, okay, well, that was kind of close to what it was back in the 20s when Hubble was first trying to figure it out. So is that an outdated thing? No, because it's not being used as a means to an end. It's stated as a fact unto itself. Oh, that's why our modern numbers are way different than that, you know, 2 million or 3 million or something light years. They could give us that number because the better we think we're getting at it, the farther we're getting from the truth. See, the whole point is that the Andromeda Galaxy is actually a million light years away, not what we think it is. No, what we think it is now. The more we think about it, the worse our number is getting.
In that case.
In that case,
see? In other cases, it's getting better. Right?
Well.
Like you said, the Hubble constant maybe is changing.
Right, but see, but the Hubble constant is irrelevant. But the distance from here to the first outer space level is important to give you the sense of the scale of things. I mean, I can, you know, we could spend $500. You can go through every single number in the book, and I can tell you contextually whether it's a number that, you know, you should be running with or not. It's not arbitrary. I mean, you figure it out in the context. Okay? I mean, here, you know, 450, you know, is not a means to an end. Okay? They're just giving you that so that you can calibrate the distance scale measurements. They're giving you a million for Andromeda, so you can calibrate the distance measurements. They give you the whole astronomical distance scale is a very complex thing that requires a whole bunch of different calibration points because it's not all one method. It's a whole bunch of methods kludged together.
But for me, with no background in that science, for instance, it's like, you know, you're talking Greek.
Yeah. The book is not written for, it's written for PhDs in every field.
To
a PhD in Jesus, a PhD in the Bible.
It's also written for the humblest and the, you know,
the... No, that's the fourth ethical revelation. See, that's the thing. A lot, you got to understand.
God living within you and that kind of stuff. I mean, it was all part of it.
Right. But the Gnostics thought that God was living in you. Right. See, so that you have to have that more sophisticated ability. If you have an unsophisticated mind, you don't want. I mean, the fifth ethical revelation, you know, will be a very problematic thing in the hands of unsophisticated minds. There's a whole bunch of things here that could be very abused.
That's the way it is right now.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's meant for someone who has an integrity. You have to be a critical thinker. You have to be able to determine whether or not, you know, a scientific fact was being used temporarily or not. It's like, well, how can you do that? That's what the scientific method is for. The scientific method is to try to figure out truth. Not facts.
So, what bearing does the fact, so let's say Andromeda, the truth of that have on the growth of your soul?
I agree with that question.
You're right. Most of the stuff in the Urantia book doesn't have anything to do with the growth of your soul.
It's mostly
that's what's misunderstood. The fourth epical revelation is just about you and your relationship to God. God is your spiritual father. Okay, he came as a spiritual uplifter. The fifth ethical revelation isn't here as a spiritual uplifter. Here as a philosophic uplifter, which means if it has less science than religion, it won't be true. It has to have just as much science as religion, or it can't be true philosophy. You have to have just as much ability to get into the details, what the etymological meaning of a particular word is when they're talking about thought adjusters. If you don't burrow into the precise details, if you don't know the science of etymology, you will misinterpret the thought adjuster papers. You can't just approach it religiously, quote unquote, you know, with a unity eye. Everything in the Urantia book is only properly interpreted if you have your unity eye open and your, you know, I should maybe do it the other way around with the left, right hemisphere sort of a thing. I mean, your unity eye open and your individuality eye open. You have to have both an individuality consciousness and a unity consciousness simultaneously in a super-additive state so that you have a cosmic consciousness.
True, but I must say that it did an awful lot for me without that kind of consciousness in being able to grow as an individual and spiritually and so on and so forth. Maybe not spiritually is the wrong word, but you know what I'm saying. In other words, as far as So I think that maybe there's degrees to what you're saying for different people in different places.
I mean, retelling the life of Jesus has a rudimentary aspect to it that is helpful to just about everyone that is open to having the, you know, the story of Jesus being retold to them.
For me, the first papers are like,
okay, you know, or some things in the first papers about how, you know, helping you with what Jesus tried to teach about, no, he's your spiritual father, not your anthropomorphic material father. You know, the first five papers can help you with that. Okay, and, you know, and letting go of the atonement doctrine or things like that. Okay, yes, there's all kinds of elements like that. But those are factual resets.
True.
See? So, yes, you can read the book, and the extent to which you can recognize facts at various points, you can reset some of your facts, facts about God, some of your facts about Jesus. But it still says that it's a revelation of truth. Okay? And the truth is not in any of the words where you're getting those factual resets. So at some point, you can challenge yourself to go beyond some initial factual resetting and try to know the truth and obey the truth. Remember, Jesus said, all of you who have been factually reset, even with the revelation, and know the truth, you still languish in futile yearning because you obey not the truth. It's one thing to see or feel the truth, you know, remotely. It's another thing to actually be able to engage it precisely and obey it, to walk with it, not just be inspired by it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not like I have to prove this. I mean, how many pages in the book don't talk about you and your salvation? A lot of pages. It's just self-evident that the book is not just about you and your salvation. You know, and if not to mention that it tells you at one point, you should just take your salvation for granted and move on to the next subject. Okay, so it only takes one sentence to treat your salvation, you know, you're in your soul. You got a soul, you're saved. Okay, now let's try to get into philosophy. I mean, that's the point of the fifth epical revelation, to try to develop a personal living philosophy predicated on just the triviality in the big picture that you're saved. I mean, there's nothing to think about there. It's you know, all that's fine. Now, let's do something with that. Let's rework paleontology. Let's rework history. Let's rework physics. Let's rework astronomy. Let's rework government. Let's rework sociology. Let's rework psychology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I'll tell you about the rebellion.
That's what this is about.
Yeah. Adam and Eve.
Okay. The fifth epical revelation is about a better set of initial assumptions for all the things that you want to do once you recognize that you're a child of God. And if you do those things, subsequent to that recognition of your child of God, you will become something called an adult of God. This is the first time we've been given guidance on how to become an adult of God. Jesus didn't tell us anything about how to be an adult of God. He tried to get us to teach us how to become children of God, to enter the kingdom. He didn't explain what you're supposed to do once you get in. Right? The fifth epical revelation is trying to take it to the next step. Now that you've entered, your salvation is a given. Now what? Now what? You know, what am I going to do for trillions and trillions and trillions of years? You're going to try to become a master of philosophy, the Revelation tells you. You want to be able to get there with the masters of philosophy on the Isle of Paradise and learn to think the way they do. It's like, well, why do I want to do that? Well, because they give you an amazing thing in the fifth epical revelation. They define a word that we've used for millennia. They define the word worship. And it doesn't have anything to do with anything that anyone has ever imagined. The actual definition of the word worship is to philosophize. Now, you want to do that thing with the conductors of worship on the Isle of Paradise. Who teaches you how to worship? Not the conductors of worship, they're just the conductors of worship. How do you know how to worship so that they can conduct you? The masters of philosophy teach you how to worship. It has nothing to do with how you sing or what you think. I mean, you know, in the normal sense, we think of worship. You know, it's above knowing the truth. It's above obeying the truth. It's thinking the truth, to philosophize. It's something that humans have basically never done. You know, what are they, you know, in Jesus' papers, and they're trying to redefine the words prayer and worship. You know, they tell you worship is super thinking. Thinking the truth. You know, in the earlier part of the book, they explain what they mean by super thinking. Thinking the truth. Something that no human has ever imagined worship was. And in order to think the truth, you have to be able to, you have to have your three discriminators in play, those three cosmic intuitions. You have to be able to engage the revelation and discriminate between true and false interpretations. There's millions of false interpretations possible.
So what's the hope for those?
But only one true one.
That don't have the intelligence yet.
The mansion worlds. that's why there's mansion worlds.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, none of us can do this in this short little ignorant life. If we could do this in this short little ignorant life, this incredible thing I'm talking about, there wouldn't be mansion worlds. It takes you 8 worlds to really master what I'm talking about.
With a better mind.
And who knows how many years. Right, and mind, a mind beyond anything you can imagine right now, right? I mean, you got to get several mansion worlds in before, you know, they tell you before this whole thing about cosmic consciousness actually becomes more than just a pipe dream, okay? It takes some serious mind to actually do that definitively.
I appreciate you taking the time.
Okay?
It's very important.
No,
well, I know.
But you know, I don't want to dismiss what a person can get in a cursory fashion engaging the book. I mean, that's undeniable. You know, if you're open, it can completely change the way you think about a lot of things. Okay, but recognize, you know, they could have boiled down a lot of that stuff into one paper. You know, why is there so much, you know? Why are we talking about Antares? What does this have to do with my soul?
Yeah.
Why are they going to explain white dwarfs and stuff? What does this have to do with my soul? Nothing immediately. Other than if you can think about deity and stars in the same mind, you will have a capacity of mind that you don't currently have. And a mind energy system will fill that bigger capacity. That when you copy that, will make more than an embryonic soul. You know, it's about, you know, a child of God can be represented by an embryonic soul. An adult of God needs something bigger. And you know, an adult of God is a master of all science, you know, all religion, and everything super additive to that. Okay, meanwhile, back to stars. All right, so, you know, remember, we're going through two papers here where you're not going to get a lot of immediate stuff about spirit, substance. These are two papers about things. Okay, so you're trying to understand things in these two papers. Okay, now these star things, they're telling you that basically they come in sizes from 10 solar masses to 30 solar masses. And if they're bigger than 30, they're going to split in two, you know, or, you know, if not more parts. You notice how in the first part there they say, when suns are too large, when suns that are too large are thrown off on a nebular wheel, thrown off of a nebular wheel, they soon break up or form double stars. Okay, so, you know, it might break up into more than two things. And then there's this whole bit about semi-liquid. Okay, this, we won't get to this tonight, but as we get into this a ways, they're giving you some hints about the mystery of gas, liquid, solid. Those three states. Those three states of matter are not what we currently think they are. Especially liquid and solid.
I don't know, you go outside.
Okay.
Either ice
is. Right? Yeah. I mean, we call it ice, but you actually know what a solid is. And the answer is no. Physicists don't know what a solid is. Doesn't matter how many much they've analyzed ice or bricks of iron or whatever. It's because atoms are not what we think they are. We assume atoms are like little billiard balls. Okay? Atoms. You know, atoms, if you assume they're like little billiard balls, you know, that might work pretty well in a gaseous state. Okay? But the mysteries of liquids and solids that are currently unresolved have a lot to do with the fact that if you assume atoms are billiard balls and then try to rationalize liquids and solids, the rationalization gets very convoluted.
Doesn't it say like in paper 12 they're all spheres?
They're spheres, but they're not spheres of stuff. They're not spheres of mass. They're spheres of motion.
Motion.
Okay? And that's a very different fact. Okay. But the point they're trying to make here is that you have a quasi-liquid state that a star can go through in its evolution. You know, no matter how much that's mysterious, nonetheless, if you're thinking about it, you know, a rotating blob of liquid, you know, you can really picture that bubbling into two drops. Okay, there's just so. So, you know, without going into any depth of physics, just, you know, the appreciation of that and a level that we all can appreciate, that's why they mentioned that. You can form double stars in a lot of ways, and that's one of the ways, you know, because of that liquid phenomenon. Okay, now let's read one more paragraph here.
The most recent of the major cosmic... Hang on, my eyes are blurring on me. The most recent of the major cosmic eruptions in Orvantan was the extraordinary double star explosion, the light of which reached Urantia in AD 1572. This conflagration was so intense that the explosion was clearly visible in broad daylight.
Okay, now.
That's bright.
It's now.
Just on the news and from out of China, wasn't it?
Okay, now. You know, we all know that they're talking about a supernova here, what we call a supernova. There's some mysteries, if you know anything, though, about supernovas that strike you. You could do a quick little search and go, wait a minute, it's the most recent was Tycho's supernova in 1572. What about Kepler's in 1604? You could see Kepler's in the daylight. That was more recent than 1572.
Not by much.
Not by much. But what's the deal? Okay. Did you just find an error in the book? Now that doesn't seem too likely since it's the authoritative elimination of error, unless that sentence is an error. Did you find outdated science? Well, I mean, 1604 and 1572 are both pretty much in the rearview mirror relative to the beginning of the 20th century.
Was the other one also a double star explosion?
Okay. Well, we don't know what these things are.
Okay.
But the most recent of the major, a word as simple as that. You can't ignore that. You know, and if you say, well, no, I'm not going to give that weight, well, then you're not a student of the Revelation. You have to understand the Revelation, every word is very precise. Okay? If your unity consciousness doesn't want to give the word major as much weight as the word cosmic or the word eruptions or the word Orvinton, then you can't, you'll never interpret the book properly. You have to be precise.
So what okay? was the other one? A minor one?
All right, they're pointing out that something that you can quickly discover, Tycho's was significantly brighter than Kepler's. So there is an obvious major minor just in, you know, the apparent brightness that we observed. Okay. But there are, you know, there's some mystery here. They're obviously pointing to this one because we speculate a lot about double star systems being involved in a certain type of supernova. They're validating that this particular one was a double star explosion. Now it's looks like it might have been not what we normally think of, where one of the stars is a white dwarf, and it's taken matter off of its companion star, and the white dwarf has exploded, which is what we think this supernova was. Looks like it maybe is something a little bit different, where maybe both stars, maybe the two stars spiraled together and collided, exploded. Again, they're trying to open up. You know, they're saying there's some truth to your ideas of thinking about binary star systems being involved in some supernovas. We're giving you a little clue that this one did involve a double star. We're not explaining exactly how it involved a double star, because we're not allowed to. That would be a violation of the mandate. But we're giving you that little data point to hang on, you know, that it was a double star. This is the kind of thing that they're doing. And the consequences of little tidbits like this, you know, can't be worked out right now. Hundreds of years down the road, as we're developing a better science, leveraging off of all this, all of these little data points will come into play, being the little helps that we need. I'm just trying to, you know, it's not happening very fast here. But what I want to do, basically, as we go through this, is just give you a little sense of what future generations will do with this information, not what I can do with it now. Okay? And even some of the things that I can do a lot with now, you know, we're not going to spend 50 hours on one paragraph showing you what you can do with that.
Future generations that are looking for the truth, not the facts.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. They're trying to develop
today,
a...
Today, people looking at the facts are saying what you said, well...
See, how does this relate to truth? Okay, you can't get true philosophy unless you have true science and true religion. True philosophy is the superadditive consequence of true science and true religion brought together. Okay? They're giving you what you need to develop a true science. Okay? Right now we have a false science. We're trying to, you know, it is about truth. You know, there isn't just spiritual truth. There's also scientific truth. You can put the word true in front of every noun like that. Okay? So we're not just about trying to find spiritual truth. We're also trying to find scientific truth. You know, governmental truth, etc.
Truth.
All truth. Okay? And so this, each one of these paragraphs is just a little data point that we're going to need down the road to develop a true science, okay? And they're telling you that that supernova, unlike other ones that have occurred in the Milky Way galaxy in recent centuries, is an extraordinary one. It's one that you should think about more closely. Don't just throw it in the mix. Oh, it's one of those types. Okay. No, this one is unique enough that it got mentioned in the fifth epical revelation. Okay. Not even one that was in 1604, you know, let alone, you know, the one that made the Crab Nebula, you know, in the 11th century and stuff like that. Okay. They mentioned just one here. Because it must have, the more you study that, it'll give you things that are important to get the big picture. They're clues. It's a series of clues. Okay. You know, what you're looking for is not in the words. It's something that is down the road from the words. All right. So me, just that little tidbit.
When I read that, you know, it didn't really matter to me when it happened or so on and so forth. It was more like, wow, if it's that intense and you can see it during the daylight, you know, that's really sort of putting an exclamation point on it, on how much of a cosmic reaction this is.
Right.
You know, that was how I looked at it. I didn't even think about quite. Didn't even know about the others, didn't even think about questioning it one way or another, just kind of got the feeling of that, wow, that's quite an incredible blast,
right,
so to speak.
Right, so...
And
so
then I don't think it's something I'll probably even remember on the Mansion Worlds, because I don't know if I have any significant, but maybe it will. Mm. But, you know, it's relative to here on Earth. But I just, you know, so unless there's some truth behind it that...
Okay, so, I mean, just... Not to belabor this, but right, but see, you saying that, like we said, there's some, you know, if you're uneducated, you know, like if you've never
in this area,
mm-hmm. if you've never studied, you know, astronomy at all, mm-hmm. so that you don't know that supernovas are visible in daylight, okay, then in passing, you can get that little factual point. But, you know, but you could get that from the Wikipedia page too. You know, you don't need the fifth epical revelation to get that fact point.
That's the significance.
Okay.
But I didn't know it was one of the most in orbiton. I wouldn't have known that.
Right. No. But we're just talking about the daylight thing. Just focusing on the daylight part. I mean, you know, what you were bringing up there. Okay. I want everyone to appreciate why they would mention that. It's. I mean, your point is valid. They want you. To be reminded of why they use the word conflagration. It's not a little burp of a star. It's an incredible explosion. You know, where if a supernova goes off in a galaxy in the second outer space level, it shines brighter than the entire galaxy. It's a very big explosion. Now, if you don't know about supernova, you don't know that. Okay, but you're made aware of that in the context of the fifth epical revelation. You know, so yes, that's part of the picture, reminding yourself of that's a key element. It's a really huge explosion.
Well, by this point in time, are we beginning to understand that a point in of light was like a sun?
Yeah, right. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the first really... you know, significant astronomers starting to, you know, like Tycho, you know, that this one is named after, you know, he did measurements that in many ways are just as precise as what we do today. You know, he was doing some serious stuff, okay? You know, you've got serious science going here now. Okay. Yep.
Oh, I just wanted to make sure I understood, because really what I'm hearing you say is that it's important and significant to understand the science, because the religion or the true religion is already being revealed. So once we can get our minds around the science, then we can actually worship, because now we have a fullness of philosophy, and that's the purpose of it.
Right. I mean, you know, and right now we're just focusing on the science. A lot of other parts of the book are trying to get you to have something besides the false religion that everyone on the planet has. You know, they tell you every religion on the planet is false. Every idea about God is false. Matter of fact, they're so false that the only word they say to describe the ideas in religions on the planet is grotesque. They're that false. Okay, so, you know, as much work as we have to do in science, we have just as much to do in religion. I mean, there's nothing that you can rest your laurels on. Everything is false, and you have to rework everything. All of your...
That seems like an exaggeration to me.
Okay.
I mean, Christianity teaches that Jesus was God. How can that be, like, you know, false?
Okay. The false in what? What do we mean by false? Does it mean that it doesn't have ideals that are valid? No, it doesn't. That's not what that means. There is a recognition of ideals in religions that are valid. But it's not the ideals of God that are in question in the fifth epical revelation. Remember Jesus, and he tells you that point blank. Remember he told that to the apostles when they were interacting with Rodin. He said, okay, it doesn't matter about the ideas of God, he said. I'm here to just deal with the ideals. I want you to get valid ideals about the infinite and eternal Father. Okay, so I want you to have a proper relationship to the goodness. But truth is another matter. Truth is a superadditive consequence of the relationship between fact and goodness. So you can have all the proper relationship to goodness in the universe, but if you don't have a proper relationship to fact, you can't have truth. And the fifth epical revelation, see, is not about the ideals of God. It's assuming you already have that. The fifth epical revelation is about the ideas of God. From the very first paragraph to the very last sentence. You know, when all is said and done, is it the Father ideal? No. It's the Father idea. What's the difference between your ideas of God and your ideals of God? Your ideals of God may be tied to the truths of existential eternity properly. But your ideas of God, which have to be connected to facts, that's another matter. And for the first time in human history, we have a revelation that's trying to get us into that. It's trying to tell us that even when your ideals are fine, your ideas are grotesque.
They don't match your ideals.
Right. They can't because they're tied to figment.
So then teaching that Jesus is God is an ideal, then, as opposed to an ideal.
Well, no, it's a notion, and it's a false notion.
Yeah, I remember we're at this certain state in our evolutionary progress. I mean, and we're on a planet that, you know, that's...
For instance, is there any religion that knows, that has the proper idea of the word God? Is there any religion that defines the word God as personalized deity?
Yes. Called Hare Krishnas, and their Vaishnavas in India.
Right. But they don't know what the word deity means. See, this is what we're trying to get at. I mean, the word deity has been used, but not correctly. You know, I mean, again, all of this is, you know, this is the challenge the fifth epical revelation is trying to put forward. If you're comfortable with your current ideas, you're not looking for revelation. You're looking for affirmation. Okay. The fifth epical revelation is here to say you have initial senses of things. Eastern religions got some initial sense of deity, but not focused enough to produce a true picture from it. Western religion, you know, coming through, rooted in the Near East, got some better ideas of God as a person, but nothing even vaguely really about deity. So you have some vague ideas about personality on the one side, you have some vague ideas about deity on the other side. If you can get both of them better focused and put them together, then you can start to get somewhere. But you have to be a person who wants to let go of their current religion and their current science. The fifth epical revelation here is not for everyone. Remember again, it's not a dispensational revelation. It's not meant to be given universally. And it's certainly not meant to destroy the faint flicker of faith that some budding religionist has. We're not going to get through this section. We'll probably say maybe we'll even start the section over again next time here. But let's just stick on this for the moment, because this is obviously really plaguing a number of people here. And it's not surprising that when we finally get to these papers about the physics, that those who found the Urantia book because they have an interest in spiritual things would be very confused and discombobulated. And then even more so when I start talking the way I have been. Okay, talking in these very definitive terms about things that people don't want to hear.
Or haven't heard.
Okay. Let me stress this again.
It's a bitter pill.
Let's take a Buddhist. A very sincere, humble Buddhist. Okay? Is there something wrong with them in eternity? No. Do they need the fifth epical revelation? No. Do they need the fourth epical revelation? No. Do they need the third epical revelation? No. Especially in the wake of Pentecost, everyone has a soul by grace. Everyone gets to leave this ignorant life behind and start anew with some clarity, on the first mansion world. Okay? That humble little sincere Buddhist who may not even have even a vague idea of God as a person, unless they're kind of getting over in the Amida Buddha sort of land. But if they're kind of old school Buddhism, they have no idea of a personal God at all. They don't need an idea of a personal God to survive this life. Their soul is fine. Everything is fine. You don't have to tell them anything. You don't have to correct them on anything. They're fine. They wake up in the next life just like the most profound personal living philosophy on the planet. But if you want to get into more advanced school, there are some issues that come into play. You go to the section in the Urantia book on Buddhism, and do you find something that you should hand to that totally fine, sincere, humble Buddhist, let alone hit him over the head with? No, you find a statement that says that their ideas are a grotesque perversion of the ideas of Gautama. Okay, is that what you should tell that humble, sincere person? What it says there in the fifth epical revelation? Should you shatter that faint flicker of faith in that little child of God by telling them that their ideas are grotesque perversions, even of the limited thoughts of someone in the 6th century BC? No. Okay. The fifth epical revelation is for a very small subset of people who are no longer satisfied with their current understandings of anything. They're ready to let go and start anew on every idea of God they've ever had, every idea of atoms that they've ever had, every idea of history that they've ever had, and want to start all over again. And you say, well, why would you want to do that? does it get me to heaven faster or something? No, it doesn't have anything to do with you and your soul. It has to do with civilization. The fifth epic of Revelation is not here for you. You aren't in an emergency. Jesus fixed the individual emergency 2,000 years ago. The emergency in play is not individual. The emergency that the fifth epic of Revelation here is for is collective. There's a civilizational emergency. We've sailed out of the sheltered bays. And sailing out of the sheltered bay doesn't matter to you individually. No real harm can befall you as an individual. It doesn't matter if you drown on the high seas or drown in the shallow bay. You still wake up fine. It has nothing to do with you individually. But the civilization out in the out on the high seas, if civilization flounders and goes under, that's a problem. Okay? It's not about us as individuals. It's about the future of civilization. There are countless things that are falling apart relative to the ongoing integrity of civilization. And they tell you you're quivering on the very brink of a fork in the road. Either there's going to be a minimum number of individuals who reacquire some cosmic integrity of philosophic thinking and can be the foundational elements, the leaders of civilization, or you're going to have a dark ages again, a deeper dark ages and a longer dark age than the 9th century one you had before. Okay? That's what it's about. It's about individuals. I mean, we now have such a false science that's so corroding our youth. I mean, that false science, starts indoctrinating our children, in a materialistic viewpoint. From the moment they start kindergarten now. And a few years of steeping in that horrid brew produces nihilistic children, that are producing chaos, in our society. When you get to the marriage and family papers, 3 papers on marriage and family, are those papers about you as an individual? No. They're about the civilizational consequences of marriage and family. And that all of the institutions, all of civilization is predicated on integrous marriages and family. And that's in jeopardy and is about to collapse. If the family collapses, then civilization, by definition, collapses because all of civilization is built upon it. Okay? Now, you want to challenge yourself to be integrous in that area, not for you. It's not about you and your experiences in a relationship. It's about civilization. You have a duty to civilization. You especially have a duty to civilization once you have recognized and taken hold of the fact that you're a child of God, once you've done what Jesus told you to do. Okay, to him whom much is given is now much expected. You're not expected to just sit there and say, well, I'm cool, and who cares, if Rome burns, I'm saved. No, once you know that you're a cosmic citizen like that, you have a duty to try to do what you can to supply the foundation for civilization. Even the children that you have are not your children, they're God's children. You have a duty to raise a child so that they can become a cosmic citizen, not so they can be a delight to you individually. Okay? That's not the point. So
if both happens, it's okay.
If both happens, that's great. I mean, if you raise them with integrity, they will be a delight to you.
Yeah.
Right?
Always.
Yeah.
Most of the time, opinions
vary. If they grow up integrous, let's put it that way, then they'll be a delight to you. I mean, sometimes, it's difficult. You can try to raise them integrously, and it doesn't work. Okay, but you get my point. Right. I mean, this is what it's about. It's the fifth epical revelation is a phenomenon where when it talks about ancient Egypt, if you can't get yourself up to a PhD level of Egyptology, you can't properly interpret what they're saying. Because all of it is stuff that only the most in-depth person in that field knows, where there's this little question mark that's being glossed over. You know, the armchair person doesn't know about that. And the revelation is speaking to that. You know, if you don't know the Bible better than any biblical scholar, you can't interpret what the revelators are saying in various places about the Bible. They say something about the first Psalm. If you aren't a better scholar of Hebrew than all of the Hebrew scholars, you can't interpret that paragraph. I'm thinking of a particular paragraph. You have to know how to properly translate the Hebrew because it's currently being falsely translated. You know, and so you have to go in depth. You know, if all you know is searching an English translation of the Psalms, you know, you can't even remotely approach what they're talking about in that paragraph in the Revelation. That's what the Revelation is about. Thousands and thousands of people for the next 1,000 years.
Right. So they're not necessarily here yet.
Right. I mean, especially there'll be humans to do this once we have a magisterial son that can help to lead this process. Yeah. But even if I can't do a lot of this stuff, I at least recognize that that's what it's challenging me to do. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, and each person in his own, with their own ability, you know, where you can do, you pick something you have the ability to do.
Yeah. In order for me to interpret the second paragraph we read tonight, I spent about 4 hours trying to teach myself enough about those details to be able to properly interpret that. You know, I worked all day, right, to get my little pea brain educated enough to see if I could truthfully interpret what they're about to tell me. I have to have
a PhD in this, though, right?
I don't have a PhD in this stuff in particular, but I have an ability to engage stuff at that depth, and so I know. That's my first step, is to know everything that current scientists know and then see what they are missing and then apply it to the revelation. Because if I can't go beyond the current astronomers, I can't interpret this. If I stick with the surface of the astronomers, there's no way I can interpret that second paragraph. I have to see what they're missing. So I have to see what they are seeing just as clearly as they are, and then use insight to penetrate beneath the surface and see what they aren't seeing. That's the way it always is. The whole revelation is like that.
Because what we're trying to do is build civilization based on truth and not based on falsehood.
Yes, okay. Right. That a stable civilization can only be founded on truth. You know, and we're starting to see what it's like if you try to base a civilization on falsehood.
We're saying it big time.
That's what we're experiencing. Why is everything unraveling? Because we're trying to realize ideas that are predicated on false initial assumptions. You know, if you take the initial assumptions of progressivism, which are false, and try to live your civilization relative to those, don't be surprised if everything starts to unravel. The initial assumptions are false. There's positive desires behind it, but they're false, you know? And there's a paragraph in the Urantia book that addresses that set of initial assumptions and says those initial assumptions are some of the most horrendous false initial assumptions that you've got going.
Incidentally.
You know,
use the word incidentally.
Just, you know, the whole point is like, well, yeah, but I've devoted my whole life to trying and believing that if we just could be more zealous about those initial assumptions, we're going to have light and life on the planet. Yeah. No, the more zealous you are, the more you're going to have the rebellion on the planet. You're going to have change without growth, which is not just going to be potential evil, it'll be actual evil. You know, and they say, you show a surprising willingness to believe those assumptions. If you had any critical thinking skills, you could immediately see that those are false. But you've turned off your critical thinking skills because you've got this zeal thing now, especially amped up by Jesus 2,000 years ago, spiritual uplifter. He really put some fuel into this idealism that we can have now. And, you know, you just closed your eyes to the obvious falsehood of those assumptions, and you're just trying, you know, to make them your complete lifestyle solution, your ism. And if you just that one ism will collapse civilization.
Progressivism?
Progressivism. Not to mention secularism and humanism and positivism and several other really biggies.
Reawakening philosophy. Watch where the universe progress or something like that.
Yeah.
That's not progressive.
But yeah, if I just call anything progress, does it make it progress? If I, you know, see, that's the thing. Like, there's an ism called positivism. It's like, well, what could be wrong with positivism? Well, the technical fact that what you're calling positive is actually negative. That could be a problem. But I'm calling it positive, therefore it is positive. No.
It's like wishing on a star. Excuse me.
Yep.
So the reason that we came up with a couple of the classes we did is because we think that this discussion is really, really important, and learning about the rest of what we need to know in a really logical, precise manner so that you can just step through it very clearly. Yeah. You want to tell about those two
parts? Right. I mean, that's the whole point of that two-part seminar, Reawakening Philosophy 1, Reawakening Philosophy 2.
And you know, Total Deity.
Plus the Total Deity seminar. That, you know,
Don Green says it's so hard.
Between the two of them.
That's okay.
Right. But the whole point, truth is difficult. If truth was easy, they would never have to reveal truth. We would get it by ourselves. Okay, truth is the most difficult thing you can do. You won't master it until the Isle of Paradise with the Masters of Philosophy. You know, it's the most difficult challenge you can put before yourself to actually find truth and not just find pleasure in dotting I's and crossing T's of a rationalization scheme. Getting the correct answers.
Yeah.
Science gets the correct answers, you know, to a lot of questions, but the theory is false. It's like, well, who cares if it's false if it gets the correct answers? Well, you should care, because if you've aligned your mind to follow that false scientific theory, that means your mind can't follow truth anywhere else, because truth is holistic. You have to have it all. It's a binary thing. It's all or nothing. Okay, and so we have that reawakening philosophy is we have 33-hour sessions in those two courses just to get the basics in place. To do what the revelators say you must do, to construct a sphere of true philosophy, it's composed of two hemispheres. A lower hemisphere, which you have to do totally yourself, that's the human philosophy. You have to know everything that the greatest philosophers that ever lived knew and go beyond them, know where they were in error and where they were in truth, and take their truth and flesh it out and get the lower hemisphere. And then the upper hemisphere you get with revelation. And if you put revelation and human philosophy together, then you can have true philosophy. All the divine revelation in the universe can only give you half of what you're seeking, they tell you in the fifth ethical revelation. The other half is up to you. You know? And so why do we take a paragraph and we try to find the truth in it and try to run with it? Because at best, what they've given me directly is only half of what I need. I need at least, you know, the same amount in addition that I have to acquire myself. in order to get the full truth. So it like I said, it involves a lot of work. And just to get going on the basics of deity, as the Revelators want you to define the word deity, takes 40 hours. That's a 40-hour seminar to just get the basics of deity.
That's fabulous.
Okay.
And then when I asked Don what it is, he still can't tell me.
Right, because it's... Right.
I'll draw you a picture.
Okay. Because again, it's truth is not knowledge.
My point is that even at that state, it's not simple. It doesn't
It's very, very complex.
And it's one thing, you know, that, as you said earlier, is not what people are brought up being taught of. So it's not something that you've been able to gather over a long period of time of being able to, you know, you've been taught maybe things that society believes are to be true, but you're actually saying crap.
I mean,
you're not willing to necessarily throw that away.
I mean, the fundamental quality of deity is unity. And historically, there is a tentative association with the humans using the word deity when they're in a mode where they're contemplating unity, like the more Eastern religions had a greater tendency to do, in contrast to, you know, a Judeo-Christian with a more individuality, you know, focus. Okay, but to actually think of deity as a substance. Okay,
it takes quite a bit of
is a big step.
Thought.
I mean, and deity is a substance that's transcendent of the fact that spirit is a substance.
Yeah, that's true too.
Okay, so.
But so, you know, like I know hundreds and hundreds, maybe even 1,000 people who have been reading this Urantia book for a long period of time, and all I can say is that yes, I'm not disagreeing with you on its intent and its usage, but I don't see that manifesting at this stage, maybe this early stage,
there.
In most of those people.
That's right.
Very few of them, and you know the same people
I'm trying to start something new. I'm trying to start something new. A phenomenon of engaging the revelation, being a student of the revelation, with more than just an immediate goal of improving my data points about the life of Jesus, say, or my data points about God. I'm trying to start, you know, an effort to engage it in a more holistic fashion.
So that other people will begin to look at it.
So that we can begin to go beyond the surface of it. Okay.
As a collector.
You know, what we, you know, we need the best PhD level person that's ever lived in every field. And we need them to come together with a willingness to reform everything they've thought. Okay, and then we'll start to have something happening. Okay.
What about for the average Joe? Or Joan?
You know, we've talked about this a lot.
Okay, but that's...
An average person needs the third epical revelation. And then if they get the third, they can go to the fourth. I mean, the average person doesn't need to sort out ultimatonic physics.
No, but the story of life after death is quite interesting.
Yeah, right, right.
All right, I think the average person who is a quick study might get inspired to find out more and dig really deep into subjects.
Right.
And you don't have to get a degree from a university in order to be a very bright person.
Yes.
You can dig into a subject and learn a ton and self-teach yourself and ask questions to others.
Yes.
And bring yourself up. So, you know, if you are feeling challenged and really interested in something, you know, go for it.
Right.
And learn about it and study. And so the quote-unquote average person off the street, if they're really bright and they're inspired, of course they can get a lot out of this.
Right. When I try to usually say it. If I missed it one time tonight, I shouldn't have. You know, You need a PhD level of desire to engage. You don't have to literally have the document. You know, most likely if you have that, let's call it, you know, a PhD now, it's just a technical degree and it's of no use. But you have to have a desire to engage things at beyond a master's level. Okay, the reason they call it a master's of science, and then they call it a doctor of philosophy. Okay, why? Because as you go from a master's to a PhD, you're going from fact to truth. At least that's what it's supposed to be. It isn't the way it is anymore. But that was why they created PhDs. The whole idea was you finally had enough relationship to the facts of the field that you could begin to engage the truth of the field. I mean, why is Veritas in the logo for Harvard University? Well, they don't know anymore because they've forgotten truth, okay? But it's there, you know, and it's a doctor of philosophy because there used to be a recognition that the whole point was to start with fact, get yourself grounded in facts, but then to try to strike step with the truth. Not just use facts to make technology.
That's what's happened.
Okay, a true scientist is someone who is engaging. The purpose of the scientific method is not to figure out facts. It's to distinguish truth from falsehood. Okay, and truth and falsehood are not, the so-called true and false questions, which are actually correct and incorrect questions. Truth is something very different. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to reawaken the philosophy because that's what the revelation is trying to do. It awakened in the 6th century BC, went forward on some inertia for a few centuries, and then began to die. And it died as it entered the 20th century. And we went into primitivism at the beginning of the 20th century, and then achieved pre-primitivism as we got to the middle of the 20th century. We're now, we've lost our philosophic integrity, and our civilization is collapsing. Remember, there's never been more than 1% in any generation who've been leaders, could be leaders. Those leaders can't be pre-primitivists like they are now, or we're all going to perish civilizationally. They need to be cosmically conscious individuals to some degree.
Is that why you say that it's not a universe, it's not dispensational revelation, it's not meant to be given universally, because not everybody's at that level to perceive that situation.
And not everyone has to be yet. Right. The whole point is to find a core group of people who can refound civilization. It's just like the third epical revelation. It wasn't meant to be universalized totally. The real potent stuff that Machiaventa did were just for a few to establish a lineage of potential leaders so that Moses could come out of that. The vanilla stuff, gave you Abraham and that line. And that was basically just sort of propping up the second epical revelation. But the real definitive thing about it being a non-dispensational revelation, the third, was to produce, working with the Kenites in that line, so that there could be a leader when a leader was needed. It's the same thing here. And as we go forward, when we get to the magisterial son, he's going to do things that universalize this sort of phenomenon. Remember, a magister of the sun is a philosophical uplifter, right? And it'll be a dispensational effort. He will do that for the whole masses. Like, well, good grief, how are you going to do that? We have people who just got out of the Stone Age in New Guinea. Well, yeah, so yeah, there's some issues here that you can ponder about how it is that he's going to be able to do that universally. Apparently, things are going to have to change some before that can happen. Okay. But right now, you're looking for a handful of people that not only want to think about God and their personal relationship to God and life after death and their thought adjuster, and but also want to think about, well, what about the nature of the atomic nucleus? Is it really a collection of protons and neutrons, or is it something different? You know, what about, you know, what happened in 150,000 BC in Mesopotamia? What actually was going on there? I mean, you're looking for people who want to think about all these different things, okay, and have supply the favorable conditions for a mind that can be grown to encompass such a broad perspective. If they supply the favorable conditions so that God the Mother can grow the, you know, a broader mind, coincidentally, there'll be a person who'll have the integrity to lead when going gets tough on the high seas that we're now in. Right? We don't have people that can help us when the, you know, we're seeing that the going is getting tougher and the leaders are getting poorer. Okay?
We have no leadership training at all.
Right. I mean, you know, it's hard to find anyone who even, it's like, well, I don't know, leading, that sounds kind of, isn't that kind of intrusive? Should I really be intruding upon others like that and being a leader? Shouldn't we all just be the same? Okay, I mean, if we're getting that fuzzy, you know, things are going to get really problematic. Okay? There has to be those where some things are self-evident, and they know it, and they lead relative to that, definitively. Okay, we've gone way over time here, but That was kind of an interesting diversion. I had no idea we were going to go that way tonight. But, you know, I'm thinking what we, you know, it'd probably be really helpful. I mean, what we'll do next time is we'll just kind of review those paragraphs that we've already read, you know, and then we'll get into it again. But, you know, I don't mind doing this occasionally. I mean, I do it incidentally, you know, often, but it's important to appreciate what we're attempting to do here. We're attempting to do something very exceptional, very, very different than what any human has ever tried to do. And we have to be totally comfortable with our relationship to God as an individual. And that, knowing that we can talk about anything and it doesn't affect that integrity of relationship to God one iota. I can question every idea of God I've ever had, and I'm still just as intimately and eternally bound to that God.
That's hard for a lot of people.
It's very hard, right. Yeah, but that's what the revelation is looking for those people. Who have done the full measure of what Jesus said to do, to be in a state where you fear not. You can think about any subject, no matter how politically incorrect, no matter how much it's your favorite thought, and you can hack into it with a machete, and it doesn't affect the stability of your mind one iota. You have peace that passes all understanding. Others are going, how could you possibly question that and still have peace? How could you question, you know, what happens when you die or something like that? As soon as I question that, I go into hyperventilation panic. Right? I go catatonic. Right? So that's what the revelation is about, is for those who are ready for courageous and independent cosmic thinking, independent of what anyone has ever thought, no matter how brilliant they were, no matter how close to the truth they were. You have to try to somehow be independent of the greatest minds that ever lived.
And then you've got the Supreme. Once you do that, then you got to do something about it.
Right, right. So once you are something more significant, then you got to do something with it. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. All right. let's take a moment and reflect upon how we talked about a lot of things besides things tonight.